Continuing in Genesis, we finished up chapter 6 last week, and we're starting into chapter 7 today, which gets us into entering the ark. We won't get clear to the actual flooding today. Well, yes, we will. We'll get to it in terms of its initiation, but we won't get through what it was like to live through the flood in the ark and that kind of a thing. So, just reminding us where we were in Genesis chapter 6, it's very clear that the mankind and the world and all it's doing had become corrupted. We had demonic participation with mankind. Mankind didn't have a problem with that. God said through what's written here that every thought of man and every intention of his heart was evil, and it played itself out in violence. So it was a violent society. It wasn't just that people were cheating and whatever. I mean, there was undoubtedly bloodshed and other kinds of things when you see that word violence. And God is saddened or sorry, depending upon your translation. But he was sorry he created the world and mankind and what was in it. He specifically focused on man, said he would not strive with man forever, that man was flesh, and that he planned to blot out life on this created world. But he also mentioned Noah. Here was Noah. He found favor in the eyes of God. He was righteous, blameless. In Hebrew 11, it's clear that his faith was reckoned to him as righteousness, and he walked with God. And one of the things that God commanded him to do, we saw that in chapter 6, was to build an ark, and we talked about the dimensions, over 500 foot long, and it was going to be for him and his family and for animals to come into that ark 2 by 2, and he was to take food for himself, and the animals were going to eat that same food. And so that takes us to Genesis chapter 7, verses 1 through 16, so I think it would be good if we would read those verses, if I can get a volunteer or maybe even a couple of volunteers to read us through those 16 verses.
Then the Lord said to Noah, "Go into the ark, you and all your household, for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. Take with you 7 pairs of all clean animals, the male and his mate, and a pair of the animals that are not clean, the male and his mate, and 7 pairs of the birds of the heavens also, male and female, to keep their offspring alive on the face of all the earth. For in 7 days I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and every living thing that I have made I will blot out from the face of the ground." And Noah did all that the Lord had commanded him. Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters came upon the earth. And Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him went into the ark to escape the waters of the flood, of clean animals and of animals that are not clean, and of birds and of everything that creeps on the ground. 2 and 2, male and female, went into the ark with Noah, as God had commanded Noah. And after 7 days, the waters of the flood came upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the 2nd month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. On the very same day, Noah and his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife and the 3 wives of his sons with them entered the ark, they and every beast according to its kind, and all the livestock according to their kinds, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth according to its kind, and every bird according to its kind, every winged creature. They went into the ark with Noah, 2 and 2 of all flesh, in which there was the breath of life. And those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in.
Okay, was there a little bit of repetition in there?
It was.
Yeah, and in some respects, excuse me. And in some respects, this whole passage has a lot of repetition from things we even looked at previously. although there's also some differences. And we've talked about this a little bit before, but when you see repetitive things, what does that tend to mean, that it's repeated? Need to remember it? It's important. And often, additional details may be added. But it's emphasis. I mean, that's really where it's at. It is emphasis. This is really a big deal. And so let's start out here in chapter 7, verse 1. Then the Lord said to Noah, enter the ark and all your household. This is a command. It's an action. Get in there, Noah. It's time. So who's his household in this case? Who's there? His wife. Three sons. And their wives. The sons' names are Ham, Shem, and Japheth. That'll become more important to us after the flood. But for now, we just see them as names. And according to this verse, why was God choosing Noah?
Because he was
a righteous man. And I, God says, I have seen you to be righteous. And I think that's an important set of words there. This could be taken a couple of different ways. One is that Noah himself had just been extremely righteous. And I think there's going to be truth to that understanding of it. But it's also true that you could say there's an element of declaration here. I am seeing you as righteous. I'm seeing you as the righteous man that I'm going to choose to save. And so there is some declaration on God's part as well. And in this time, when Rick read it, his version said in this generation, and what that really means is, were there other men before Noah that God would have said was righteous? Certainly. You can go to the pinnacle of that. Enoch was very righteous. He walked with God. Similar kinds of words as what's said about Noah. And we know that he even took him because he just was no more. But currently, he is the righteous man. And then in verse 2, he says, take with you. What does he say to take with him?
Seven pairs of all the clean animals.
Seven pairs of the clean animals. And?
Two.
What's that?
Two of each of the others.
And two of each of the others. As well as?
Seven birds.
Seven pairs of the birds. And so he's to take them. How is this different from what we read over in chapter 6, verses 19 and 20?
Just two of each.
There was none of this seven pairs business, was there? And so God asked him to do that. We could look ahead, and maybe you have. Do you know one reason, at least, why he said take more clean animals?
Sacrifices.
When they come out of the ark, there's going to be sacrifices. Well, if you only had two, that would be extinction upon leaving the ark. And so he's preparing for sacrifices. That'll be over in Genesis chapter 8. So clean and unclean. What makes an animal clean or unclean? How do you know?
Split hooves.
So where are you reading these? Where are you getting those things?
Leviticus.
That's the Mosaic law. That hasn't been given yet. Would it have been the same thing? Maybe. But we don't know for sure. And it could even be, who's writing this book? Moses. Who wrote the Levitical book?
Moses
and the other law-giving books that would distinguish these food laws and clean and unclean. And so he may be saying this, defining it based on his audience. You all know what clean and unclean is. So the clean ones, he was to take seven, and so the clean ones might have been the very same description as we would see over in those books. But if you look at it from a chronological standpoint, that direction to mankind hasn't been given yet. I say to mankind, was that for everybody? The clean and unclean, the food laws?
Just for the Jews.
That was just for the descendants of Abraham. As a matter of fact, was that a permanent condition for the descendants of Abraham? No, we go over to Acts, and God says, well, we're done with that. Which was a real crisis for Peter, wasn't it? What do you mean we're done with that? I have never violated this. I'm not starting now. And God said, yeah, you are. You're not, because that was small potatoes compared to what God really wanted him to do, which was to take the gospel to Gentiles. I'm going to go in a Gentile house, not on your life. God said, no, on your life you're going into a Gentile house. So he did that. So that was one of the distinctives to set the Jewish people apart for their testimony. So why was it here? You know, we're not given any information. And we can take that either way and be possibly correct. That the unclean animals were defined in the same way. Or for whatever it is, it's not a problem for Noah, is it? He didn't go, what do you mean clean and unclean, as far as we can tell? There's nothing recorded that was an issue. And so he took those clean and unclean animals aboard. And he also took the birds also by seven. So were they clean? Well, it looks like it because they were lumped together. We'll see in Leviticus. That's not the case. We will see in Leviticus. You can see in Leviticus. I don't know that we will all get there together. But in all cases, the purpose here, God says it, is to allow the created animals and man to survive, albeit in very small numbers, right? We are doing a major reset. This is a calamity. It's a calamity that God brings about as judgment to mankind, but we are back very close to the original creation again in terms of quantities of species alive on the earth. As a matter of fact, in creation, the creation for these animals is often plural. Does that mean plural because there are many kinds? Or does that mean plural because when he created rabbits, he created a lot of them out of the box? We don't know if he created 2 or 2 million rabbits in creation. But here we know we're going to do a reset with a maximum for the clean animals of 7 pairs. 14 animals is going to restart the population of the earth. Which, by the way, let's see, do I have that somewhere else? I don't see it. We'll talk about it right here. If I've got it somewhere else, we'll let it go. How is this going to work? So, what's that?
God's going to take care of.
Well, God's going to take care of it, that's true. But, so let's take one that's a little bit of a stretch for us, some of us that aren't from Australia. What family is the kangaroo in?
Marsupial.
Okay, but if we were to talk about the kinds here, not all marsupials are in the same family. As a matter of fact, the base animal that they say that the kangaroo is a part of is the rabbit family. And the rabbits aren't even marsupials, right? So how do we get kangaroos out of rabbits? Or for that matter, you could go around Kansas. I assume most of you have seen a jackrabbit. Are they like the bunny rabbits you find running around your yard? No, very different. My wife had an education about that one year when we hit one with a car, and I said, please don't hit it. And she hit it anyway, and it was kind of expensive. It's like, well, it's just a rabbit. How did it do all that damage? Well, it's a rabbit that's, you know. There are rabbits, and then there are rabbits. And I knew the grill on this particular car, because I'd replaced it the week before, was particularly fragile. Now, she didn't know that, but it was still fragile when I replaced it the next week then. But you know, there's a lot of varieties out there, and how do we get there from here?
Well, don't you think all the DNA, when God created the animals, all the DNA of everything was in the first original animals?
Yeah, and people, this is one of the objections to the flood. Well, he couldn't get all of those animals in. Well, no, he didn't take every kind of rabbit. He took rabbits. And they had the DNA, and that just blows some people's minds. And yet, the more obvious thing doesn't come up. Have you heard of tension between the races of people? Have you heard about that? Do you know that's out there? How many different kinds of people do we have in the world? I mean, we've got Asians. We've got, you could just keep going through the list. And some people are darker, some people are lighter, some people's eyes look a little different, some are taller, some are shorter. You can go through all of that. We can kind of pick out the descendants of Abram, can't we? I mean, there's some characteristics that go along with being both Jewish and Arab. And we can kind of look at that and physically and say, you know, that kind of has some similarities. Now, they vary a lot. How many pair couples did all of the people of the world come out of? Huh?
One.
And nobody says, well, wait a minute, that won't work. But when we get over to animals, they go, well, that won't work. And yet, if we trace it all back, we all come out of Noah, and that doesn't seem to be a big problem. And of course, they had somewhere between 7 and 9 billion people on the earth before the flood. Seven's kind of a more common but yet pretty conservative number. They all came out of how many couples?
One.
Adam and Eve, two people, one couple. And so if we're going to start believing the scriptures, you have that kind of a spread of changes within people. They say that the variations among people, if you look at it on the DNA level, because your DNA has to tell your body that's being formed in the womb to make lots of things. Hearts, eyes, fingers, go through all that. They say the variations between people are, in terms of the DNA differences between us, is less than 1%. Yeah, that's kind of wild, isn't it? Because, but if you think about it, I mean, there are birth defects, right? There are occasionally some mutation issues that come up. But for the most part, we're all the same if you get down to the pieces and parts. And so the variations between us is done by a very small number of DNA. And so that's what's going on here as Noah is taking these kinds of animals into the ark. There will be a lot of variation later. And even if it wasn't already packed into the DNA of the people, is it a problem? No, because who's doing it? God's doing it, so it's going to work out just fine. Go over to Acts 17:26. I did have that in here, and it's right here. Acts 17:26. Acts, if you had said to me, what book of the Bible would you find this in? I would not have picked Acts, because there's not a lot of teaching in Acts, but yet we do have a few occasions where there is some. And this is Paul when he's in Athens. And what does Acts 17:26 say?
And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place.
So out of how many did God make all of the men of the earth?
One.
So it continues to be reinforced through Scripture. Now, we've got Noah with the job of getting all of these animals in the ark. I mean, even though it's a lot less than having every kind of rabbit on the ark, he just has rabbits, there's still a lot of kinds, right? Do you think that was a big job for Noah? Well, it certainly, if we asked you to do that today, you would go, forget it. I'm not even going to start that silly task, right? Now, you have to remember a couple things there. One is, who asked him to do it? Because you're not going to say back to God, what, are you crazy? You know, that's just not going to fly. You could tell me that and be right. But here's Noah with the job of doing it. And we'll have another thing to say about it just a little bit later. But first of all, I want to take us over to Genesis 1:26. Let's read that again.
Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.
Now, we're after the fall with Noah, right?
Right.
But before the fall, how does God describes man's role with regard to the animals?
Care to take care of them.
That's really not what the word dominion means. Now, that's true. It's not wrong, but yours said dominion, right?
Oh, that's right.
Anybody else have a different translation than dominion?
Rule.
Rule. So God put mankind in charge of the animals. I don't know what that looked like, but it could have been very directive that with the animals, you know, we talk about domesticating animals. They may have started out command ready. I don't know how that ruling over them worked, but certainly God gave mankind dominion over those animals. Now go over to chapter 2, verses 19 and 20. Now we're rereading the same, well, a similar time. It's still creation. This is the day that man was created. And we get more details in chapter 2, right? This is that repetition with more detail and the emphasis. What do these verses say God did on that day that he created Adam?
Which verse?
Chapter 2, verses 19 and 20. Did I get the wrong words? Verses?
No.
Okay.
Out of every living thing with flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the earth.
No. Revelation. Genesis 2.
I got the wrong chapter.
Genesis 2, 19 and 20.
Now out the ground, the Lord God had formed every piece of the field and every bird of the heaven and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called every living creature that was its name. The man gave names to all living stock and to the birds of the heavens and to every piece of the field. But of Adam there was not found a helper fit for him.
Okay. So what's going on here? Did we have our first parade? Yes? And who are the participants? So God said, hey, you guys parade yourself in front of Adam. We got to give you names. And they just marched on through, right? So is it going to be difficult to fill the ark? No. And I'll even give you another point when we get down to verses a few later. So looking again at verse 4, or beginning with verse 4. For after 7 more days, God said, so he gave this command a week before the flood's going to start, 7 days before. I will send rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will blot out from the face of the land every living thing that I have made. And so here's the rain coming. We need to know there in verse 7 that this word for rain is what we would use as a standard word for rain. Like we would have, say, hey, we got a rain shower going on today. So it's just a simple word that the Hebrews would have used to talk about, we had some rain. Okay, and so God says this is coming. And verse 5, once again, Noah did according to all that the Lord had commanded him. So what I don't know is, was on day 1 of that 7-day period, was everybody in the ark? And they were there for 7 days waiting on God to shut the door? Or, which we'll see a little later, or did it take him a week to get everything in the ark, and there's a lot of things to put in the ark, so maybe so. But either case, God says, hey, in 7 days it's going to start. Get in the ark. So let's go down to verse 6. Now, Noah was 600 years old when the flood of water came upon the earth. So Noah has reached his 600th birthday. This is 120 years after God made the original declaration. Verse 7, and Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him entered the ark because of the water of the flood that was coming. It wasn't there yet, obviously. And then we get some of this repetition go on of clean animals and not clean animals and birds and creeping things on the ground. They all went into the ark. Now, this interesting words here. And it says, and everything that there went into the ark. Now, this could be a little different. What did your version say? They went into the ark what, Noah?
With Noah.
That's an article there that could be either way, or preposition, I'm sorry. That could be translated with or to. A lot of commentators like the two better. Their vision of this is, and it sounds reasonable to me, Noah went into the ark, and the animals just by God's direction started coming into the ark with him behind him, and so then he could start directing them to their particular personal apartment, their locations within the ark. They came in to Noah by twos. Can you imagine, first of all, if there were cats on the ark, if you tried to keep them together by twos, how's that going to work? If man is herding them, right? And so you're not going to, so if these animals are coming in two by two, this is not Noah's arrangement. He is, God's bringing them into the ark by twos, male and female, just as God had commanded to Noah. And it came about, verse 10, after the 7 days, that the water of the flood came upon the earth. Now, this water that came up, it says, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on the same day, all of the fountains of the great deep burst open, and the floodgates of the sky were opened. What is, so, if we go back pre-flood, what do you call the second month of the year?
February.
We do. Did they? Matter of fact, if it was the Hebrew second month of the year, it would have been about May for us. Mm-hmm. We don't know. We just know that it was the second month of the 17th day of the month. Why so exact? What difference does it make? Well, it's got to rain for 40 days and 40 nights. That's a great answer. There's more. When you record a historical event, do you go, oh, somewhere a long time ago something happened?
Or about?
No, you give very exacting details. Are we getting some pretty exact information already?
Yeah.
We are. And we're also getting the exact time it started. This isn't some myth, right? Myths don't have these kinds of details given as fact to go with them. So what happened when the fountains of the great deep burst open? What are we talking about?
Must have been geysers, I guess.
Okay, go over to Genesis 2, verses 5 and 6.
No bush of the field was yet in the land, and no small plant of the field had yet sprung up, for the Lord God had not caused it to rain on the land. And there was no man to work the ground, and a mist was going up from the land and was watering the whole face of the ground.
So let's check your memory. It had not rained yet. Matter of fact, until we get here in the Bible, we don't have any recorded rain. So the earth was not watered by rain. How was it watered? We talked about that. There would be a better word than mist. Do you remember?
Streams,
fountains. It's like springs coming up out of the ground. They tended to flow, and you can even see how that made up the rivers that get talked about in the book of Genesis. And so the water isn't coming from above. The hydrological cycle that we think about didn't exist at all. Water didn't come from above. Water came from below. And it would flow up. You would water the ground. The things would grow. Men would use it. Now, in our current hydrological cycle, what happens to the water after it's used?
Evaporates.
It's a cycle. The amount of water doesn't change. It just changes its composition. That can be broken down into hydrogen and oxygen, but give it a chance. It'll go back together. I mean, some of these things happen. But when you're all said and done, the amount of water on the planet, pretty much constant. Now, where it is might change. If we're looking at moisture-laden air before a great big series of thunderstorms, it's a lot of water in the atmosphere compared to a day when it's dry and cool and nice. But the water came up out of the ground and went back into the ground. And so when we read this verse, my imagination goes to these water storage places in the ground burst open. What does that word burst imply?
Erupted?
Exploded? Everything you talk about will have some pressure behind it, right? It didn't just seep out, did it? It came out with some force because there was something driving it. And a lot of people that look at Genesis, and I don't know if we need to go here, but they look at it as, well, they try to figure out from physics and the earth and what they know about the earth how this happened, and they go to volcanoes, and that heated the water, and the water came under pressure, so the water that came out of the ground was probably 250 degrees, so it would go right to steam, they just go crazy with it. That's my opinion. What do we know? The earth was watered from below at this point, and all of a sudden the watering happened very quick. They burst open and just released their water onto the surface of the earth. Now, we didn't just get water from below, did we? Where else did we get it? From above. The floodgates of the sky were opened, and the rain fell on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. This word for rain is not the same word. Our best way to translate that would be to say a torrential rain fell on the earth. This redefines what we might say from us old-fashioned folks would say. It was raining cats and dogs. I mean, it was raining big cats and dogs. This is a monumental rainstorm from above. Now, what burst open? What are we talking about in the above water? So let me tell you a fact, a guesstimate from our current understanding of where water is at on our planet. If you instantly took all the water out of the atmosphere and put it on top of the earth, over the whole earth, we're talking about an inch worth of water. Now, is that an exact calculation? Certainly not. Maybe it's 3 inches. But it's not enough to cover 17,000 foot tall mountains. Now, we know the earth changed during the flood some. So maybe we didn't have 17,000 foot tall mountains, but we had more mountains than Kansas does, I'm sure, throughout the world. As we look at this, where did this water from above come from? Go to Genesis 1, 6 through 8. I knew it couldn't be in chapter 2. Genesis 1, 6 through 8. Take you back and see if you can remember what we talked about way back a long time ago.
And God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening, and there was morning the second day.
So when God created, it's talking about separating a lower water from an upper water. And that has led to a lot of different ideas about what the created world looked like before the flood. And many believe there was a massive amount of water stored in the upper atmosphere. And then they get into all kinds of things about what kind of pressures that would create on Earth. And it probably would have a lot to do with men living a long time for a couple of reasons. One being that if you, for example, double the pressure on Earth, every breath you breathe would have twice the oxygen in it for the same volume. And so there's a lot of things going on that they believe would be good about that. It would also, if you had this water canopy over the whole Earth, it would diffuse the ultraviolet rays and some other things, and you can say goodbye to things like melanomas and those things that tend to be detrimental to us if we get too much sun. As I age, I'm discovering I did a lot more damage to me when I was younger than I knew. And so those things tend to go away. Some people say that's why men lived a long time. Well, we can say for certainly that God is why men lived a long time. That's how he created it. He saw that it was good. We don't know the specific causes, but that's some of the beliefs, some of the ideas that go with that. There are some problems with that, because if you were blocking out all the UV, you would block out enough other light that you wouldn't be able to see stars and moon, and the sun would be kind of a orangey glow over there somewhere. And so it's not a perfect science to go down these paths and work them out. People have, it is interesting, I'm not going to spend much more time here, but people have doubled the atmosphere and put plants in an environment with twice the atmosphere, and boy, do they grow well. Now, they don't need oxygen, they need CO2, but the CO2 just flows into them, and man, plants thrive if you double the pressure from 14.7 to twice that, 14.7 pounds per square inch. So, but the picture here in creation is there's an expanse of water up there. And when we get through with creation, or through the flood, we have a new thing come about called the rainbow, right? We know that's coming. That makes that much more possible if you get rid of that expanse of water. That might be why it wasn't there before, maybe why it wasn't there mentioned before, and it's some new phenomenon when Noah leaves the ark. But let's just say it this way. That expanse of water that's up there, with the description here, there was more water than we have in our atmosphere for sure, and that water is turned loose and comes down upon the world. And then we get to verse 13. This goes on 40 days and 40 nights. In verse 13, we get to, on that very same day, Noah, Shem, and Ham, and Japheth, and the sons of Noah and wife, and his three wives and son, with them, and their sons' wives with them, entered the ark, they and every beast of its kind, and all the cattle, and so on and so on. And so they went into the ark, in verse 15, by Noah, by twos. We've heard all this again, right? And was all the flesh that had the breath of life, those that entered, male and female of all flesh, entered the ark as God had commanded him. The Lord then, this is where I'm headed with all that, closed it behind him. So they're saying on that day, everybody went in, was there, they're all there, and God closed up the ark. So we know that God is active in the ark loading, right? He probably put all the animals in there or had them come in to Noah, and then he closed it up. An interesting thing for Noah is at this point he's committed. I mean, they're not going back now. And I don't think we ought to ignore this. Some people make more of it than I would. They say Noah had to be rich to build the ark. You know, when God asks you to do something, do you have to do it by your own money? Maybe. And he'll give you the money if that's how you want. But, you know, I don't know that I want to go down that road. But imagine the most righteous man on earth today. He still, if to go through what Noah's going through, there's a lot of, he lived 600 years. There's a lot of life he's turning his back on to do this. And so he is, to know the salvation of the Lord, he's got to turn his back on the world as he knew it. It will never, ever, ever be the same again. The death and destruction that's coming on the world is unprecedented and has not been repeated. This is a God-level judgment of evil. And it's going to change Noah's life forever. James 4:4.
before God. Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God.
Can you read that verse with a little bit more understanding after looking at what Noah had to put behind him? He could have stayed friends with the world. Don't know that he was friendly with the world, so to speak. But, I mean, if there's things in the world he cared about, they're gone. Absolutely, completely, thoroughly gone. And when he comes out of the ark, it's not going to be the same world. Things are going to move. We'll even talk about this a different day in a different way. But if he like, you know, walking around with the animals and whatever, going to be a pretty limited number of animals to walk around with, right? I mean, things are changing. He cannot be friends with the world and be in the ark, because God is bringing full judgment on the world. I see your frown.
Well, it's just a question. I read that as he's not really talking about trees and grass and stuff like that. He's talking about...
That's true in James.
Okay.
But if you put yourself in Noah's world, you could include anything you want to talk about.
Everything.
Noah's grasp on the world he knew had to be completely gone. And we're not saying he was overjoyed with all of that. I mean, God created this world, and God said it was very good, right? Now, it was corrupted, but it was good. And so there were aspects of it that any of us would go, oh, boy, what am I in for now? But the love of God has to be so much greater than the love for the world. Yes, sir, Barry.
Well, I'm just thinking, you put yourself at enmity with God. That means you're probably going to go to hell.
Yeah.
The guys, other than Noah and his kin, drowning and watching all your family and friends drown, that's got to be pretty close to hell. My imagination conjures up
was,
a pretty nasty hell. But
I'm sure
this drowning, and there is absolutely no, you know, saving yourself or your family or your kids or your grandkids at all.
Yeah. Now, in his case, we think all of his descendants were on the boat.
Well, I mean,
everybody else's, I mean, yeah, it's, I mean, this is God performing a great judgment on the world. I mean, nothing like it before or to this point since.
Well, it seems that, you know, God gave everybody 100 years to get on board with this.
Actually, 120.
But, you know, none of them did. All they did was laugh at Noah.
So,
could they have saved themselves? I'd like to think so. I don't know. But
I don't know either. It's a little bit like Sodom and Gomorrah. Hey, if there's 20 guys over there that are okay, can we save them? Yeah. What if it's only 10? I mean, you get down to it's like, never mind.
Yeah.
It's not going to just... I'll quit wasting my breath.
So, you know, enmity with God is not a good place to be.
It's not a good place to be. Not at all. There are some things we can learn about God from this flood. What are some attributes that you see of God from this flood story that since chapter 6 and 7 so far, what can you say about God?
Sovereign.
Okay. Merciful. Grace.
Wrath.
Judgment.
Well, he's incredibly consistent with his honesty. I'm going to do it, and he did it.
Yeah, I like that, because he keeps his promise. Yeah. And that's what we rely on today.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. You can count as much on God's promises as in the positive direction as you can in the negative. What else might you say?
Well, you know, he did love Noah and his family, so.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I mean, it goes with Judges, I guess. He's just.
So we could keep going with the list of attributes of God. Some of you have probably done studies. There's much more that could be said. When we get in today's world, and we look at what's going on in many, I'm going to use the word churches and whatever, there are some things we hear. What do we hear in the world of Christendom about hell? Is that a real place?
Oh, loving God really would make it.
If God loves, my God's a God of love.
But that's your God.
Well, yeah, that's not the real true living God. The point I'm trying to make here is we get to see in very graphic form that God is just. And because mankind is so laced with evil, that's why we get over into the scriptures where it says God is both just and justifier. Apart from God justifying us through the work of Jesus Christ, none of us would have hope. And so when people try to say, well, you know, I'm going to be as good as I can, and I think that'll be good enough for God, we need to realize we've got some really strong evidence of God's clear judgment upon the world that is not only coming in a physical way, in a different form. It won't come by water again. God promised that. And there is also a judgment, you know, for it's appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment. We need to take that seriously, and we need to help those around us take it seriously. Why is it that mankind wants, in many cases, to refuse to believe in a flood, is unwilling to say this is anything but either a local flood or a myth or some, you know, teaching tool? This is just a story so we can learn something. Why does mankind run from things like the flood?
Well, if God's that big, he can do anything he wants, and we don't really believe that.
Yeah, mankind is willing to accept a God that loves in the way they imagine a loving God would love them, right? But mankind isn't willing to accept a God that will actually judge them in the way God's going to judge us. And mankind's not willing to put hope in another. We want to, I mean, we act like it's an American thing. Everybody wants to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. No, it's not an American thing. That's around the world. People want to be self-sufficient. They want to say, I'm good enough. They want to be able to say, I'm okay. And some know they're not, but many would say, well, I'm better than most. And so there's a desire amongst mankind to reject the flood, but the flood is real. We get details, we get dating. There's a lot of evidence. One of the animals that we don't see today are the mammoths. And it certainly appears that we're still actually mining mammoth remains. It wasn't that long ago they were going into the polar ice caps and finding mammoth remains and going, hey, look at this. This is wild. They're there on the North Pole or near it, and they were eating lush green vegetables like they were in the tropics. And they, you know, and some say, well, see, that the mammoths must not have been on the ark. Well, no, probably baby elephants were. And for whatever reason, I mean, we do have animals that have gone extinct. For whatever reason, we didn't get others to follow along. But it really looks like that was a result of the flood and the ice caps that formed afterwards. There are places in the world that when explorers found it, one of them, they said, well, it's made up of sand and mammoth bones. And there's a lot more mammoth bones than there is sand. Yet today, it is a source of a lot of ivory. Now, ivory's not very popular. It's even illegal to have it or to buy new pieces. You can have it if you bought it before a certain date, but they banned the importing of it because they're trying to keep people from going out and poaching elephants just for their tusks, and I understand that. But there are places in the world they can go and just pick up ivory still by the ton because of all these mammoths that died in the flood. And when we look at the strata that is typically used as the primary basis for evolution, How do you get the strata, meaning the various layers of fossils and sediment and all that? That comes from lots of water under a lot of pressure in a hurry. It doesn't happen slowly over many, many years. And so, and that's real obvious. You get plant life that grows up out of the, you see plant life going up through the strata in places. Well, that's where the sediment all came down around that plant very quickly. It wasn't that that plant somehow grew in the strata over billions of years. I mean, just there's silliness to it. I didn't try to bring a lot out here today for data. It's there. You can go look for it and learn about it. Answers in Genesis is a good place to go. But what I think this flood story also illustrates in very clear form, Jesus' comments about the path is broad and easy, and many find it, that leads to destruction. The path that is narrow is found by few, and it leads to eternal life. You want to talk about a broad and narrow path, how about one versus billions? Broad and narrow path. Now, I think today we live in a different situation. God's grace is flowing through Christ, and that's a wonderful thing. Most of us know Ephesians 2, 8, and 9, for by grace you've been saved through faith, not of yourselves, as a gift of God, not as a result of works, that no one may boast. And we certainly can't boast in our salvation. Could Noah boast in his salvation? Nope, God gave him very clear direction. Here's what's coming, judgment's coming, and here's how you get ready for it. God has given us very clear direction. He said judgment is coming, and through Jesus Christ you can be ready for it. To the point you can even approach a throne room of God with boldness. I don't think many of us are going to be too bold, though, the first time we come into contact with God. I want you to go over to 1 Peter 3:18 through 22. We've pulled a verse or two out of here through our study, but I think this is a really good verse, set of verses to conclude with. 1 Peter 3:18 through 22.
Christ also suffered for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring you to God. He was put to death in the flesh, but made alive by the Spirit, in which he also went and made proclamation to the spirits in prison, who in the past were disobedient, when God patiently waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being repaired. In it, a few, that is, eight people, were saved through water. Baptism, which corresponds to this, now saves you. Not as the removal of dirt from the body, but the pledge of a good conscience towards God, through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God with angels, authorities, and powers subject to him.
Did you catch that? There's a comparison made here between Jesus Christ and his triumph to the point of power and the ark. The ark saved a few, that is eight. And through Jesus Christ, that's symbolized in baptism, many can be saved. Christ, in a sense, is our ark. And that's really what Peter is saying here. In addition to the fact about Jesus preaching to those that were taken captive, put in a pit, that were they were there during the time that God was patiently waiting on Noah to complete the ark and before he judged mankind. So Christ is our ark, and we should rejoice in that. Questions, comments? Okay, well, next time we'll get into some of the details concerning the actual execution of the flood. That might not have been the best choice of words, but the actual completion of the flood and Noah's time on the ark, and we'll move forward from there. So let's close in prayer. Father, let us learn from the flood not only about your grace as seen in Noah, but also your holiness. Lord, you and sin do not mix. You can't look upon sin. The only thing you can do with sin is judge it. And Lord, you judged this world once, and you will judge it again. You destroyed those that had the breath of life in them with the water, and the day is coming, we know, when you'll destroy all of creation with a fire. But before that, Lord, you have brought us into your kingdom. You've offered to us the great salvation through Christ as our ark through this world and this mess that we live in. Lord, let us remember that being friends with the world, worldliness, is being your enemy. Lord, let us be like Noah. Lead us to understand what it means to be righteous, so that we might truly walk with you like Noah did. Thank you for your great love and your concern for us. It's in Jesus' holy name we pray. Amen.